It's the American dream. A big house, green lawn, white picket fence, good schools, good neighbors, shopping and restaurants nearby, upscale coffee shops, boutiques, away from all the hassles and commotion of the city. All the conveniences, just a short drive away, right there in the suburbs. It's the good life for the middle class. But that good life comes at a price that's rarely calculated. Abandoned city centers crumble, while just a few miles away, farmland and forest are being paved over to build new big box retail stores, strip malls, and cookie cutter cul-de-sacs lined by vinyl clad wallboard mansions. Join us as we take a look at the causes and costs of the sprawling of America.
We've got a westbound 8094 delay. It is just about 10 miles long, Bird of the Bishop Ford Freeway. It's pretty bad. Lake Hook down to Toohey.
Elsewhere, slow going on westbound 40 between Clayton Skinker and McKnight.
For millions of Americans, this is life every weekday.
It's bumper to bumper.
Around rush hour is really congested. Drives me up a wall because when I get somewhere, I want to be there 5 minutes ago.
As more people move to the suburbs, you know, it gets worse all the time.
I probably deal with traffic and congestion two or three times a week. I don't like it.
Stop and go traffic, on the brakes, rubbernecking, gawkers slow down. If it feels as if your commute to work is taking longer, well, it probably is. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, travel times are getting longer. Philip Salopek is a spokesman for the Bureau.
Average travel time has been increasing. There was an increase in average travel time between 1980 and 1990. There was a more significant increase in travel times between 1990 and 2000.
According to a report by the Texas Transportation Institute, gridlock cost the average driver more than 40 hours a year in travel delays. That's just delays, not driving time. And traffic jams waste 2.3 billion gallons of gasoline every year. At the price of gas these days, you do the math.
Beep, beep.
But you know what? Traffic jams are just one of the minor problems, only one of the small costs of urban sprawl. There's a lot more expense than you probably ever imagined when you start really looking at the sprawling of America.
The Sprawling of America comes to you from the Environment Report and was made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Public Radio Exchange, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation's People and Land Project, and the Donnelly Foundation.
Hi, I'm Lester Graham with the Environment Report. Many people love the good life they find in the suburbs.
What I like about living in the suburbs is it's a more friendly, slower type of environment. People are friendlier. The schools, I think, are a little smaller.
We've always lived in the suburbs. We like the privacy that we have, the space around us.
It's very peaceful.
I like living in a suburb that everybody lives nearby, like my friends live near me.
But life in the suburbs comes at a cost. You know, even if you don't live in an upscale suburb in a sprawling metropolitan area, you're likely paying to support that suburb. Economists and urban planners find there are hidden costs that are not paid for by the people who live in those suburbs. Now, if you bought a home that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in a neighborhood of similar big expensive houses, you probably think you've already paid your fair share to attain the good life. The mortgage is a monthly reminder, and the real estate taxes are another. But the price you're paying is just the beginning of the costs that make it possible for you to live there. Much of the rest of it is paid by people outside your suburb, people who never realize the benefits. Myron Orfield is the author of the book American Metropolitics, The New Suburban Reality. He says the people who live in the upscale suburbs get the advantages of the good schools and the nice roads, but they don't pay all of the underlying costs.
Most of us aren't able to live in the communities with $400,000 houses and massive office parks and commercial industrial. Only about 7 or 8% of us can afford to live there, and the rest of the region really pays the freight for that.
That's because the rest of the region and the rest of the state pay the county and state taxes that make the roads and nice schools possible. Orfield says a residential area alone doesn't generate enough tax revenue to pay the full cost.
So we all subsidize that development, and when all the resources of the region concentrate in 6 or 7% of the region's population, it really hurts the vast majority of people.
And while the cost of supporting the upscale neighborhoods is substantial, that's just the beginning of the hidden costs of sprawl. In most cases, those nice suburbs are nice because they're situated away from the hubbub of the daily grind of work and traffic and hassle. The people who live there might have to drive a little farther to get to work, but hey, when they do get home, it's a complete escape, worth the extra drive time, right? William Testa is an economist with the Federal Reserve Bank in Chicago. As an economist, he measures things by how efficient they might be. He says driving a little farther from the nice suburbs to work and back wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing.
If people want to travel further because they can live better, then it's their choice and they feel they live better with a longer commute, then we wouldn't necessarily call that an inefficiency. What it can be inefficient is when people don't pay for the cost of their own travel.
And that's the rub. If you decide to drive 30 miles to work instead of 10 miles, William Testa says the taxes on the extra gasoline you burn don't begin to pay the extra cost of that decision.
Environmental degradation, the cost of road maintenance isn't directly paid for when you decide how many miles to drive. So economists would say that driving is not priced correctly to have people efficiently choose how many miles they choose to drive.
And so the rest of the taxpayers subsidize those costs. And while the economic costs of suburban sprawl are substantial, there might be larger costs. When an upper-middle-income family chooses to live in an enclave of others in their tax bracket, it's a given that the people who teach their children, who police the neighborhoods and fight the fires, are not going to be able to afford to live there. Emily Tallon is an urban planner at the University of Illinois. She says that's a cost that can't always be measured in dollars and cents. It's a separation of the haves and the have-nots.
Social cost is that fragmentation, that separation, that segregation, really on an income level more than anything else.
And so Tallon says when a town decides it will only allow expensive houses to be built, it's decided that all labor for its services will be imported from out of town. The expense of that decision is borne by everyone else, especially the lower-income people forced to commute. William Testa at the Federal Reserve Bank in Chicago says, in the end, that cost might be the greatest one to society at large.
This, it seems to me, is very un-American and undemocratic, and something that we ought to think about very seriously. Could we really live with ourselves in a society where there aren't housing options available for people to make a livelihood, to follow the opportunity for their livelihood?
The experts say there's nothing wrong with pursuing the good life as long as everyone is paying their fair share of the cost. They say right now that's not happening, and those who never benefit from that pleasant life in the suburbs are paying much of the cost for others to do so. The costs of urban sprawl are not limited to the cost of traffic congestion and taxpayer-subsidized highways and infrastructure. There are costs to our health. Public health officials say we should change how we design communities. For the past few decades, most suburban developments have been about convenience. Shopping should be just a short drive away. Parks, just a short drive away. School, just a short drive away. If you're in a car, other than dealing with the headaches of traffic, getting places isn't that bad. But if you're on a bike or walking, crossing those multi-lane roads at busy intersections is daunting for adults, let alone children. And often, sidewalks are required to meet new codes, but sometimes they just end. A lot of times, sidewalks in sprawling areas never really go anywhere. So people don't ride their bicycles or walk to destinations. It's just not convenient. And sometimes it's downright hazardous.
It's a very busy road, lots of traffic, and I really would like to see a lot more sidewalks and trails.
There's not enough sidewalks, so with my kids, you know, I get worried about the cars. You know, unless I'm with them, but otherwise I would. Otherwise, there's just no sidewalks.
But city planners say it could be different. We could build cities that make it easier to get places by walking or on a bicycle. Places we want to go, such as school, the park, or to stores. Ellen Bassett is with the Urban and Regional Planning Program at Michigan State University.
Because we're building things further and further apart without connectivity that doesn't, you know, avail people to walk or use their bicycles. They have to drive everywhere. We're creating environments where people exercise less, are less and less active.
And the result has contributed to a decline in the overall fitness of Americans. That's most evident in children. Kids today are fatter. The rate of obesity is up. Early onset of diabetes is up. Part of that is due to kids watching too much television, sitting around playing computer games and so on. But not being able to ride a bike to school or being able to walk to the park to play soccer contributes to health problems because kids don't get enough exercise in their daily routines. Richard Killingsworth is the director of Active Living by Design. The program works to incorporate physical activity into everyday lives through the way we design communities. Killingsworth says somewhere along the line, we came to accept that it made sense to stop walking places and instead drive to the health club.
Now we've embraced the notion that we drive to destinations to do physical activity as opposed to having it a part of our everyday lifestyle. So we've essentially built an environment that accommodates something that is not physically active and accommodates one mode of transportation, and that's the automobile.
Killingsworth consults with urban designers, encouraging them to think about more than whether it's a convenient drive, but to think about whether a neighborhood is designed to make it a convenient walk to school or the park.
We've built upon the notion that the car is king and it should be the only way. And unfortunately, we cannot sustain that for much longer. We need to look at other viable modes. And as we build, if we build more compactly, a viable mode and a more efficient mode clearly would be walking or bicycling.
And increasingly, urban planners are being urged by physical fitness experts to think about public health. Risa Wilkerson is with the Michigan Governor's Council on Physical Fitness, Health, and Sports. She's taken an active interest in land use planning. She says it's cheaper to design communities that encourage physical activity than it is for society to pay the health care costs caused by too little exercise. She argues she's not asking for that much.
That children have sidewalks that are buffered between the road with a row of trees and grass, that the parks are connected to the schools and to homes, and that people could walk to get a gallon of milk if they chose to, or to go down and visit their neighbor at the local coffee shop, and they wouldn't have to get into their automobile for a quarter of a mile trip.
Wilkerson says healthcare costs are skyrocketing. Designing communities that encourage walking or bicycling are investments in prevention of healthcare problems caused by too little exercise. Advocates of incorporating more sidewalks, bike paths, and safer intersections into new developments say local governments should also look at existing suburbs, too, to see if those neighborhoods can't be retrofitted to include a few sidewalks and safe crossings that can connect shopping, schools, and parks to homes. That way, the walk of the day can be a little farther than just from the front door to the car in the driveway. Governments are trying to figure out the best way to deal with urban sprawl, to make cities and suburbs more livable and walkable and require less travel by car. Legislators and planners are considering all kinds of approaches to manage the growth of cities. But some say government really has no business trying to stop the market forces that are driving the rapid growth. And that is the deeper debate between property rights and land use protection. Environmental groups and even much of the news media tend to look at the congestion and the loss of green space and the loss of farmland due to the rapid growth at the edges of cities. But others see that growth as driven by what people want. It's natural growth, even organic. In fact, many property owners, builders, and developers see government interference as un-American, as testimony from this public hearing on urban sprawl policy shows.
As an American, I strongly believe in our citizens' rights to pursue life, liberty, and property.
Centralized planning did not work in Russia, Cuba, North Korea, or anywhere else they've attempted it.
Are we going to mandate where they're going to live? Is this going to be America?
The land should be controlled by the individual who has paid for the land and pays the taxes on the land and should be able to do with that property what he wants to do.
Our Constitution tells us about the preservation of private property rights.
There's something deeply rooted in the American cultural ethic that bonds people to the land, or more precisely, to their land. It might be the leftovers of the concept of manifest destiny, where, in the words of one essayist, land ownership was associated with wealth and tied to self-sufficiency, political power, and independent self-rule. On the other side of the argument, some environmentalists consider sprawl to be merely a matter of greedy developers and builders wanting to make money no matter what the cost to the environment, green space, or farmland. They sometimes ignore the fact that consumer demand for larger lots and larger houses, as well as convenient shopping, is much of the driving force behind sprawl. There are extremists on both sides of the issue, and most of the time the two sides are talking right past each other. This is The Sprawling of America from the Environment Report. So, how did urban sprawl start? Well, in the 19th century, it was mostly a matter of the well-off trying to escape the noise, dirt, and soot of the industrial areas of the city. They built large houses and former pastures surrounding the cities and built communities where they could escape. After World War I, the move out of the city started to shift. It wasn't just the rich moving away to a more pastoral setting. It was the middle class, the white middle class, moving away. Part of the driving force was segregation. White flight began in the 1920s. But it wasn't until after World War II that the exodus from the city to the suburbs really got underway. There was a severe housing shortage. Returning veterans were starting families, and the government created a home loan program for them. Reynolds Farley is a research professor at the University of Michigan's Population Studies Center. Farley says those low-interest loans made the new subdivisions possible, but often those loans did not make it into the hands of the black and Hispanic veterans.
Very low-cost mortgages accelerated the movement of whites from the central city out to the suburbs, built upon the long racial animosity that characterized cities beginning at the time of the First World War and continuing perhaps up to the present.
Banks often followed a practice of redlining, not making home loans to people of color who planned to buy houses anywhere but their traditional neighborhoods. And many real estate brokers worked to make sure the races remained segregated. Farley says today when planners and government officials talk about white flight and segregation, they talk in the past tense. But as recently as 5 years ago, a federal government study looked at real estate marketing practices and found there were still code phrases that indicated whether neighborhoods were white or not.
Well, I think there is a lot of effort to underestimate the continued importance of racial discrimination and the importance of race in the future of the older cities in the Northeast and Midwest.
Code phrases such as, "This neighborhood has good schools," replaced more blatant phrases such as, "I think you'd be more comfortable with neighbors more like yourself." There remains a wariness between the races, not talked about in polite society, but it's there. It becomes more evident as solidly middle-class blacks begin to move into the older suburbs, and whites flee once again to newer subdivisions even farther from the city core. Wise land use and smart growth advocates say it's time to face up to the continuing practice of segregation. Charlene Crowell is with the Michigan Land Use Institute. She says it starts by talking about the fears between the races.
My hope is that those who feel comfortable in moving further and further away from the urban core will come to understand that they cannot run, that there are, in fact, black homeowners who are in the suburbs and moving into the McMansions, just as many whites are. And we all have to look at each other, and we all have to understand that this is one country and we are one people.
But it's uncomfortable for most people to talk about race with people of another race. Often we don't talk frankly. Crowell says we'll be forced to deal with our feelings about race sooner or later. That's because as more African Americans join the middle class, the suburbs are no longer exclusively white. The whole issue of urban sprawl is often seen as a white people's concern. But some are beginning to realize that urban sprawl and the failure to invest in redeveloping city centers are two sides of the same coin. In cities such as Detroit, white flight led to rampant urban sprawl and left huge pockets of poverty and streets of abandoned houses in the city. Hester Wheeler is the executive director of the Detroit chapter of the NAACP. He says while his constituents often worry about more pressing urban issues, he knows that it's important that African Americans living in the city recognize farmland preservation and urban revitalization are connected. The investment that pays over a cornfield is investment that's not going to rebuild the city. But black politicians largely have not been involved in land use issues, and usually they're not asked to get involved.
There is a racial divide on this particular issue. Oftentimes, African Americans, people of color, and folk who live in the urban centers are not present at the discussions about smart growth.
Wheeler says policymakers on both sides of the racial divide need to recognize that land use issues are as much about abandoned city centers as they are about disappearing farmland, which could put urban legislators and rural legislators on the same team. That's a coalition that could carry a lot of sway in many states. This is The Sprawling of America from the Environment Report. As people build new homes to be a little closer to nature, the former residents suffer. Wildlife is feeling pressure from haphazard development that disturbs habitat and intrudes on wildlife territory. And people find that sometimes can be inconvenient.
There, we have a lot of wildlife. I'd say the raccoons are a problem.
Raccoons? Tearing up the garbage cans?
Yeah, I've got dead deer on the side of the road, and the township won't scoop them away, so it's kind of stinky.
I hit 5 of them last year with the car. When you hit deer, yes, it's a problem for both of you.
And that problem isn't limited to deer. Take, for instance, ducks. Mallard ducks are one of the most common ducks around, but the reproduction rate for the duck has been declining as people move nearer to the places where they nest. Researchers with the sportsman's conservation group Ducks Unlimited are involved in a 3-year study of mallards to find out why the ducks are not surviving in as great of numbers. Tina Yerkes heads up the project. In a truck with something that looks like a TV antenna on top, fellow researcher John Simpson and she are in northwest Ohio near Lake Erie, headed out to find some of the mallard hens. Tiny transmitters were surgically implanted in the ducks, and the antenna tracks the signals.
Every day these guys go out and they track the birds. Each bird has a unique beep, if you will, a frequency.
As the truck gets close to the last sighting of one of the mallard hens they're tracking, John Simpson flips on the tracker and turns the antenna. He's pulled over along a fairly busy road and starts looking around in the roadside grass. It's hard to believe a duck could find a place for a nest here. Most of the roadside is mowed, except for a little strip of grass where we're looking.
So she's actually nesting in the ditch.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure where her nest is here, so we gotta be careful.
She's one lucky duck. A mower would kill her and destroy the nest.
Oh, there she is right there. So you're sitting on her nest?
Oh my god, yeah. There she goes.
She's got a pile of eggs too. That's her second nest.
That's her second nest?
Yeah, she had a pile in her first nest.
The duck lost her first brood to a predator. Since she'd nested close to a subdivision, it could have easily been a dog or a cat. But the researchers say in this case it probably was a wild predator, maybe a raccoon.
And then once we're finished, we just cover the nest so the predators don't see it and we leave.
It's very rare that a mallard hen tries twice to raise a brood. But in this area, the ducks are adopting a lot of unusual behaviors. Since there's almost no grassland to nest in, hens have nested in hay fields where they're usually killed at mowing time. One hen made a nest in a large flower pot. At our next stop, we found a duck in the backyard of a mobile home, and her eggs had just hatched. The owner mowed around the duck's nest, giving the mother and her eggs a chance to survive. Now that they've hatched, they'll head to the water nearby. Tina Yerke says development pressures have hurt the ducks here.
We're looking at pretty bad brood survival, which tells us that probably we need to alter the landscape and by putting wetlands back, by restoring wetlands and larger managed marshes for the broods,
And then probably also coupling that with some grassland habitat. Because as you can see, there's not a lot of grassland habitat for them to nest in here. We need to improve that.
While they try to figure out a way for mallard ducks and people to coexist, one animal is finding the suburbs are like a salad bar. Deer munch on ornamental shrubs and flower beds. Since the only predator of deer in the suburbs is, like we heard earlier, a car, deer populations are increasing. Joseph Diemert is the law director for the village of Bentleyville, Ohio, a bedroom community of Cleveland. He says, like a lot of suburban towns, residents there expect the local government to do something about what's seen as the deer problem.
One fella planted $400 worth of tulips in a nice little circle memorial in his front yard, and every time they get two inches out of the ground, the deer eat them all, so he's yet to see one tulip in 3 years. It's a smorgasbord for the deer.
Yeah, they'll eat most of the bulb, flowering bulbs. They eat those to the ground normally.
That's Jeff Chorba. Chorba is the landscape manager of Woodlock Pines. That's a resort in the Poconos of Pennsylvania. Deer love a lot of the ornamental plants that we use in our yards, but there are some pretty shrubs that homeowners can plant that deer won't eat.
Normally plants that are thorny, you know, the drier, woody, twiggy kind of plants, they don't seem to bother.
Chorba says planting marigolds helps too. Deer don't like the odor of marigolds and tend to stay away from them. Rocky borders help a bit, fences help, and another trick is spraying plants with a fungicide that's designed to repel animals. Chorba says it's pointless to try to fight the deer. It's better to find ways to simply discourage them from eating your favorite landscape plants. And then, enjoy the deer visits.
I think it's beautiful to have animal wildlife among your working place and your environment, your home. I think that they should be here. You know, mankind's been encroaching on their land, so they really don't have a choice in the matter but to come in and to look for food. I think that everybody can live in harmony. I really do.
That hope for harmony doesn't extend to all wildlife that makes its way into the suburbs and cities. In places from New York's Central Park to downtown Chicago, another animal is adapting to urban areas. It's a little bit more of an irritant than a deer munching on tulips. Coyotes are migrating into the suburbs. Coyotes will eat just about anything they can get a hold of. Rats, young geese, squirrels, and sometimes pets. In the Chicago suburb of Arlington Heights, coyotes have been a bit of a problem. Police Sergeant Nick Pecora says sometimes coyotes are pretty brazen.
In the last 18 months, Arlington Heights has lost one Yorkshire Terrier taken off the patio in the owner's presence. And in one case, the dog had an electronic collar on, and when the coyote took it, received a shock and dropped the animal and ran away.
Pecora says some Arlington Heights residents haven't been too keen on what some see as an intruding predator.
Coyotes are indigenous to the area, and maybe it's the perception that this is a large animal, and you know, the bunnies, the skunks, the squirrels, that's what Arlington Heights is used to. And a 35-pound animal walking through the yard, I think they're perceived as the big bad wolf, if you will.
Not too far away, researchers are putting radio collars on coyotes to see where they're going and what they're doing. Justin Brown is driving us around on a gravel road in a private game preserve smack dab in the middle of a suburban area. Brown is with a research project out of Ohio State University. He's just located the spot where a coyote is hiding. We can't see him, but we know he's there because of the signal his collar is emitting.
We very rarely see him, especially during the day. At the night, during the night occasion, we'll get good visuals.
Brown and his colleagues are trying to figure out why there are so many more coyotes in the suburbs and cities. One of the reasons might be car and deer accidents. Coyotes feed on the carcasses. The huge increase in Canada geese is likely another reason.
Food ranges from deer to geese to even just dog food people leave out. They pretty much run it all, anywhere that they might come across a meal.
You'd think there wouldn't be that many places for a coyote to hide in the city and suburbs, but Brown says they hide in parks, golf courses, in woodlots, graveyards, any place with a little cover. And the experts say the coyotes are probably here to stay. Most residents don't want the police to shoot the animals, so some municipalities have tried to trap and relocate them to a more rural area. But coyotes are very territorial, and they immediately head back to the place where they were trapped. You're listening to The Sprawling of America from The Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Later, we'll hear about a different way of planning communities that keeps as much nature as possible. But first, one of the big concerns that some experts have about urban sprawl is the loss of farmland. But people want to live near the countryside.
I hate to see huge subdivisions go up in place of farmland, but, you know, at the same point, that's where people want to live, so it's a give and take.
We have more farmland than we'll ever use.
I find it humorous that as people move into a nice new subdivision next to a farm, they then turn around and complain about the odor that is often associated with the farm next door.
Only thing that bothers me are watching all the farmers that won't sell it, and then when they pass away, their family sells it for a quick buck.
Often housing developments and shopping malls are built where corn or soybeans grew just the year before. For example, as recently as the 1970s, Kane County, Illinois, west of Chicago, was predominantly farmland. Now, with more and more people moving there, only about half the county is left for farming. Randall Road is a north-south road that divides the county. Although housing developments and retail stores are starting to infringe on the country setting, on one side of the road you can still see rows of crops and pasture. And on the other side of Randall Road, it's nearly solid shopping malls and subdivisions.
But in the middle of all that development, there still is one dairy farm. Mike Kenyon and his family grow hay and corn and milk cows here, but their fields are surrounded by three sprawling towns. Kenyon says Randall Road used to be the line where planners said urban sprawl would stop. They were so confident that they even said so in their planning document for the year 2020.
And they drew a line in the county and they said, we want the growth to occur here and we want to maintain this as rural, as farms. Well, how do developers get around that? Well, they go to a little village and they say, well, we'll put a big housing development over here, please annex us, and this will be more revenue, and they'll even have a sewer system when we get done. So that's what happens, is they kind of bribe the villages so they get around the 2020 plan.
And that, Kenyon says, is what's now happening on the other side of Randall Road, where Kane County was supposed to remain rural. Kane County officials are trying to implement all kinds of programs to save the remaining farmland from urban sprawl, or at least keep urbanization to certain areas of the county. But at the town and village level, many local politicians see growth as nothing but good and are willing to expand their city limits to include developments. That's because those developments help increase their tax revenue. The story is not unique to the Chicago region. It's been repeated across the United States, so much so that millions, yes, millions of acres of prime farmland in the U.S. have been lost. Rich Green is a geographer at Northern Illinois University.